can't see distance. I still can't see distance. Yeah. Can you all please join Mark Simon and stand up for the Pledge of Allegiance, please?
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you. Roll call, please.
Carol.
President Graves.
Here.
Vice President Steele.
Here.
Director Dawson.
Here.
Director Simon.
Here.
Director Tatro.
He's here.
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 Somewhere.
Okay, this is the time for public comment. If anybody has any public any comments they would like to make that is not on the items that are specifically on the workshop, which is our only agenda item tonight, this would be the time to come to the podium and make those comments. Are there any public comments this evening? Seeing none, time for public comments is closed. Moving on to the workshop, I will turn this over to staff to get us going, please.
Thank you, Mr. President. Members of the public, tonight we have Gregory Harris from Herwood Engineering and Stephen Beck from Stantec Engineering, and they're here to present the findings of the wastewater master plan to you as well as to the public. And so what we wanted to be able to do was have them go through the process, what we went through, and explain what took place, why it took place, and the results of that study. So with that, I go ahead and just turn it over to Greg and to Steve.
That's my luck. I ended up having to go get a pen anyways.
Oh, thank you. Who's going to be doing the speaking?
Steve, and I will both speak.
Please make sure you kind of pull that mic forward. This is a recorded meeting, and that it's turned on. Is the red light on the base on?
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay, if I'm ready, I'll get started. Again, my name is Steve Beck with Stantec, and I was the principal in charge for this project. Greg Harris, you all know Greg Harris. He also worked on this project, and several other people from our office were involved in preparing this master plan. Okay, first of all, let's go over the purpose for this master plan. It's fairly simple. The purpose for this master plan was to do an assessment of the existing facilities and then do an analysis of the future needs and then develop a roadmap for future improvements for the wastewater treatment plant. The master plan document, here's a master plan document. It's divided into 19 sections. And what we'd like to do is just briefly go through each of these sections, talk about the key points in each of these sections, and then at the end, feel free to interrupt if you have any questions as we go along. It might be the best way to do this.
Thank you.
Okay, first of all, for the master plan, we had to look at the projected growth for the community service district. This information was given to us by the district. And when we did the master plan, we went through and vetted these numbers, had met with the district, went over and made sure that everybody was satisfied these were the correct numbers to use. And so I don't know if there's any need for any further discussion as far as the numbers presented in this table here. But this is the basis for coming up with the projected flows and loads in the master plan. No, it's not. We do have a handout on this. You can kind of see the land use designations. They're the basis for this table.
And this is included in the master plan.
Yes, that's correct.
So specifically, the planning boundary for the district was included in the map along with specific projects identified by the district that might lie partially in and partially out of the map or even outside the map. So essentially was everything inside the boundary plus any specific project that the district brought up and said, you know, someone's talking about this project, maybe we should plan for it. With the exception of the large parcel east of the road that accesses plant number one.
If there are any questions about the content of this table, I'd be happy to answer questions on that. Otherwise, we'll move on to... Yes.
With Pantages, the A says a portion of the property is outside the current service area boundary. How far outside is it?
Look at your map, I'll show you, Brian. See where the red line is? And Pantages is this whole area here.
Okay.
But it is in our urban limit line.
It's yes. In the urban limit line. It just happens to be out of sight of where they drew the lines at the time they drew the line. Sorry, go ahead.
As is Newport Point.
Correct.
Okay, if there are no other questions, we'll move on.
Thank you.
Okay. One of the assignments of the master plan was to do an evaluation of the sewer collection system pump stations, not the collection system itself. That was not part of the scope of this master plan, but included in this master plan was an assessment of the pump stations in the collection system. And this slide right here is a table identifying the pump stations and the required improvements and the estimated cost. The total estimated cost for these improvements is $650,000, and the recommendation of the master plan is that the district establish priorities for this work and then budget to accomplish certain portions of this work each year until completed, and no time frame was given for that. Are there any questions concerning this table? Okay. Okay, the next slide here is a summary table of the existing and future flows and loads. In the slide presentation, we presented the summary table, and I'm not sure how much discussion we need to have on this, but this table right here basically shows you in the first column the existing flows and loads, and then the if you were to add the projected from the land use study and from the previous table and add this, the incremental flows and loads on this, you'd come up with the future flows and loads. Now, one item on this table that has evolved a little bit is the BOD concentration, BOD TSS and TKN concentrations on this. These numbers have been brought down from the draft master plan that you may have seen previously. And there's a whole history behind establishing what these numbers are, but the bottom line is that the BOD established for this master plan is based on a per capita of 0.22 pounds of BOD per capita per day, which is a well-established number. If you've got accurate population data, that's at least a good check and reasonable assumption to make for a planning document like this. I don't know that we need to have any discussion, but if I open it up for any discussion on this.
I'd just like to draw your attention to the average annual flow. The second number down, the first column, is currently 1.8 MGD. When we add in the remaining houses that are approved and the other items in the planning district, your flow would move to 2.37 MGD. And so that's the flow increase that comes from new development or undeveloped lots, et cetera, within Discovery Bay.
Which takes us to full build out, correct?
According to the planning area planning and area. The lots that you gave us.
Okay, are there any questions concerning this table? Because this table is really the basis for our discussion on the improvements in the master plan.
Steve?
Sure.
For clarification on that, this is where we like tested these numbers like three different times to make sure they were accurate, correct? Because we were getting some, maybe not, we weren't sure that we were exactly where we're supposed to be. So these are solid numbers because we went back and did several testing periods, didn't we, on this to make sure we were on the numbers, Greg? Is that correct?
Yes, if you may recall, specifically the numbers being questioned were the VOD, the TSS, and TKN.
Correct.
The flow numbers were pretty well measured, so we had a lot of good measurements on that. The original plan predicted a 220 VOD. When we did some testing several years ago, intensive monitoring every single day for 2 weeks in a row, we ended up with an average of 240. We were very concerned that the plant capacity would suffer. We went out again this year and tested again, and we averaged 150 to 190. And then we said, okay, we need to find a reasonable number. And based upon per capita, and it happened to lie in the middle of those two sets, we chose the per capita data, and we settled on 200 VOD and TSS for proceeding with the report.
Great. I just wanted to let everybody else to kind of know that, because we, Ray and I had that information from being in the meeting.
Okay, we'll move on. This is just a flow diagram of the existing plant, and we won't go into a lot of detail, but as most of you know, when we talk about the wastewater treatment plant, we're actually talking about two parallel treatment plants, one on both sides of the freeway there. We've got a common influent pump station, splits the flow to the two plants. Two plants consist of similar headworks with screens and partial flumes. They flow into an oxidation ditch with clarifiers. They combine again, and they're pumped into a UV disinfection system and then sent out to the river. I don't know if there needs to be much more discussion about this, but.
Anything from the board on that? This might be a good place. We've gone through a couple slides. This is a workshop kind of orientation. Does anybody from the audience have anything that they'd like to comment or question at this point? Or are we okay to move forward? And if you do, would you please come to the podium? Because again, it's being recorded for the benefit of those that want to listen to it. Go ahead, Rich.
Yeah, I have a question for the engineer. These flows that you had on the previous chart were actually measured flows at the point of time.
That's correct.
Yeah, and then you said you take the per capita and ran some numbers to check to see if it was within the reasonable range. Is that what you're saying?
We looked at the flow to see if the flow was in within reasonable range, and then more importantly, we looked at the biological oxygen demand, BOD, and maybe we should have defined that for everybody. BOD is short for biological oxygen demand, and it's a measurement of how much solid matter is in the wastewater and how biologically active that waste matter is. And that's what really sets the biological capacity of your facilities. We had a lot of varying data on that, and so we checked it, you know, we measured it intensively twice. We measured it over time at the plant, and then we also back checked that against the number of people that live in Discovery Bay and said these reasonable numbers, and based upon those three inputs, we settled on the 200 that we have there.
Do you realize that in a lot of homes out here in Discovery Bay, they're weekenders, and they don't come up sometimes for a month or 2 months at a time, or just come on a weekend, and they're not here all the time. So if you take the number of units times your population factor 1.8 or 2.0 whatever, then your numbers are going to come up with a bigger number than we're really coming. And then if you measure the flows, recommend a result of a lower population than you're projecting.
Yeah, when you look at the data on this, the per capita flows, I think it's like 135 gallons per capita per day. That is a little bit on the high side. An average number might be 100 gallons per capita per day. That could be due to some infiltration into the collection
sources.
Right. And then that might also explain why the BOD concentrations are somewhat on the lower side of what we see for typical valley communities.
Because you're getting groundwater rather than sewage.
That's correct.
Okay.
I'll also comment. higher flow per capita is also usually seen when you don't have water meters on the homes. Yes. So it could be a variety of reasons as to why the flow is on the high side. It could be infiltration. It could also be that people tend to use more water when they don't pay by the gallon.
Yeah. Thank you.
Yes, Virgil.
If the engineers wouldn't mind reporting, saying what some of the nearby communities and what they're, you've done contract work with some of the other communities, and if you don't mind telling the board and the audience here what the BOD average is for some of the surrounding communities.
If I had to pick an average number for a typical Valley community, I would pick a number about 250 milligrams per liter. So this master plan certainly is looking at numbers that are on the, on the lower side of that range. City of Merced, for example, we've done a lot of master planning studies down there. They're like, I think, like 268 milligrams per liter. There aren't too many communities that I can recite that we have designed for less than 200 milligrams per liter.
And Brent, I wanted just so you know, it's about 320.
Okay, the next section we'd like to look at is talk about the plant hydraulic analysis. We looked at the existing future peak flows and modeled those. The existing facilities can accommodate the future peak flows that were established in this master plan with suitable modifications to the influent pump station, secondary effluent lift station, and export pump station. We'll talk about that a little bit later. But primarily what we're talking about is as the flows increase, having to change out pumps or possibly modify the pumps, impellers, and motors and stuff. Are there any questions about the plant hydraulic analysis?
I'll just comment slightly. All the structures physically can pass the water. It's about upgrading the pump stations to pump that water.
Okay, the next section of the master plan talks about the permit requirements for this plant. And this table is a little hard to read, but I want to point out two areas of potential concern, and those have to do with the total coal form and electroconductivity. Both of these, we've had some excursions in our permit compliance, and we've done some things already, or the district has done some things already regarding total coal form that comes out of this plant. You've recently upgraded your UV disinfection system. It's too early to tell whether those improvements will fix the problem. And we do have some recommendations in the master plan regarding UV disinfection. We'll talk about it in a second. The second item is the electrical conductivity. It has to do with the salinity of the wastewater, the salt that you have in the wastewater. And there really isn't an economical treatment solution, and our recommendation is that in this particular case that the emphasis needs to be on source control. That might be looking at doing a study and seeing if the source of the salt that's in the wastewater is from water softeners or whatever it is. But that's really where the effort needs to go. It would be cost prohibitive to do treatment for salt removal from this wastewater, from the wastewater treatment plant.
What is the process for salt removal?
It would be microfiltration followed by reverse osmosis. You'd be looking at $15 million is our estimate. So way out of bounds of what you'd want to do.
And also explain the effluent filtration system with what would that entail? When we're talking about the total coliform.
Oh, right. So, and we'll get into that when we talk about UV disinfection, but there are a couple options, and one of those is potentially putting tertiary filters in there to improve. Okay. So we'll talk about that.
Okay.
Okay. Any other questions about permit requirements?
One comment back on the salinity removal. We're looking at a capital cost of about $15 million. We're looking at an operations cost annually of over $1 million. So that's not insignificant in our opinion, and it should be a last resort. There is salinity limits in our permit, this district is supposed to be moving with a salinity reduction plan. District is supposed to be doing certain tasks to reduce salinity. So the plan is simply pointing out if those things aren't followed up on and action isn't taken, and the board were to come back and say you have to treat it, that it would be quite a penalty to the district.
Steve, have you dealt with the communities that have had this problem before? And if so, how do you restrict the source?
Well, for example, we've done a lot of work for the city of Dixon. They're dealing with the same issue at their wastewater treatment plant. And the focus there is to look at, and they've done some, they've passed some ordinance about water softeners. They've got a buyback program. They've done some things that they're seeing some success with that, and reducing the their salinity. So there are things you can do on source control. I think the starting point for the district would be to try to identify where that might be coming from. There are some, some preliminary studies have indicated there are certain areas where it might be, it could be from water softeners. I don't know what else.
Interesting enough, in terms of salinity specifically, the highest salinity levels come out of Discovery West relative to the older communities. And, you know, our sense is it's probably the water softeners. There's been a proposal to do a test of homes turning off their water softeners and collecting data, turning them back on and collecting data so that people can see, is it really the water softeners or is it the booby? In different communities, we'll see also your surface water runs about 500 microohms. You guys are shooting 21. Your permit limit was 2100. And the goal was 500 above your background. So the goal in the permit is 1,000. And you guys are shooting 2100. Your permit had a hard limit of 2100. You guys shot 2200 last year as an average. Mm-hmm. So that's why the regional board is concerned. And that elevation from your background water EC, is pretty high relative to other communities. And so it looks like the food is either in the, people really like salty food in Discovery Bay, or it's a combination of that, the showers, water softeners.
Greg, can you explain the operational cost, $1 million, just break that down a little bit?
Sure, if you did end-of-pipe treatment, reverse osmosis takes a lot of electricity to run, and so does the microfiltration, and so you would end up just a huge power bill. In addition to that, you have to dispose of the salt. Once you take the salt out, you now you have salt in your hand. What are you going to do with that? Well, it's not so easy to just go dump salt someplace. So you got a disposal cost for that salt as well.
Thank you.
Right. For the record, I'd like to make a correction. We do have a slide that identifies it's a little over $2 million annually for the cost to do.
I just wanted to ask Rick if we could make sure to stay on top of that study he was talking about in Discovery the US. We should get on that quick.
What is the alternative for soft water systems besides the salt system?
Well, for example, the city of Dixon, what they're doing is they've got a buyback program. There's newer technologies, different water softeners that don't discharge the salt into the wastewater collection system. So the newer technology water softeners, the city's buying back the old water softeners and provide some sort of rebate so that the resident can put in a newer style water softener that doesn't discharge the salt into the wastewater collection system.
So there's salt-free solutions out there?
Right. They're cartridge type systems. Oh, okay. So you've got to dispose of the cartridges, but at least it's not going down the sewer.
All right. And it's being basically subsidized then.
In the case of Dixon, they've decided, I believe they're doing some sort of program where they're subsidizing the cost.
Okay, yes. Thanks.
We'll get to salinity reductions coming up, and we'll have a little more comment.
Okay, so we're going to kind of go through the different, I'm sorry,
comment from the public. Do you have something to say?
Just a question about the salinity. I heard you say about us, you mentioned the water softeners, and then you kind of expressed some doubt as to whether you really knew it was the water softeners and the salt therefrom. I've heard that same thought expressed before, that we really don't know whether it's the water softeners. Did the city of Dixon do anything to anything special to confirm in their minds that they knew it was the water softeners that we might do?
Yeah, they did a much more extensive study, and I think that for the district here, there's only been a preliminary kind of investigation done. In the case of the city of Dixon, they went through and did a full survey of the homes, and a bunch of different studies were done to do this, to kind of determine what they could do. And they thought that by doing the changing out the water softener stuff, that they could reduce their salinity levels down about 35% is the number, I believe.
So they came up with some hard data,
yeah,
that it was the water softeners.
Right, and they're starting
it to... It wasn't a guess. And
yeah, in the case of Dixon, I think because the program's been ongoing, that they actually have some results now that indicate that they've had some success with this program.
Thank you.
And part of the testing program was to go test it. So not guess at it, but to go test.
I'm sorry, Greg. So
part of the program that is on the table to execute how to reduce salt is actually to go test in Discovery Bay so people know what the true benefit would be if that goes forward.
In the master plan?
It's a separate study that's been proposed, and actually the reason it hasn't been acted on, it's been drafted at the regional board for 2 years, waiting for approval to go do it. But in that study, it was, let's go take some actual test data on homes using and not using water softeners. The one thing we will say is it's pretty clear the salt comes from the homes. So we measure the salt content of the fresh water delivered. It's running 500. We pick the sewer right out of the homes. It's running 2100. So it comes from the homes, and something in the home is doing it, and we have to figure out, you know, where is it coming from in the home specifically. There is data out there that water softeners, we know they add salt, so, you know, how much and what your benefit would be if you changed it, that's why you'd do the test.
Understood. Okay, so what we want to do now is kind of go through the different, you know, processes at the treatment plants, talk about them. Talk about the key issues, current issues, and recommended improvements. So starting with the influent pump station, as I mentioned, the two plants have a common influent pump station. The current issues with the influent pump station include that we have a problem with pump ragging. We have an inadequate flow splitting controls that splits the flow between the two plants. There's a lack of mixing in the wet well, the pump station, that results in, you know, that affects the, could be affecting the wastewater characteristics. We get scum buildup in the wet well, the pump station. And just as important is, right now, you don't have the ability to take this pump station out of service to do needed repairs. So in the master plan, we've come up with a number of recommended improvements to the influent pump station, which include, we've got some concrete corrosion that's going on, so we want to do some structural rehabilitation of the pump station. We want to replace these pumps. Some of these pumps are old and need to be replaced. We've got some minor piping modifications. We're recommending that you install a mixer in the sump so you don't have the buildup of scum on the surface, and then figure out a way to improve the flow splitting controls between the two plants. And then in order to do this work, we're recommending that you reactivate the existing pump station W to allow the work on the influent pump station, and then the side benefit would be to allow pumping raw sewage to the existing emergency storage space that you're not capable of using right now. And so this, by reactivating this pump station, this would give you the ability, if something really went wrong with the plant, you've got a way to divert the raw wastewater, at least for some time, into an emergency basin. The total estimated capital cost for these improvements is about $1 million. Are there any questions on the influent pump station? Okay. Okay, immediately downstream of the influent pump station, we have the headworks. The headworks is where the screen takes.
Steve, let me interrupt just a second.
Sure.
I'm sorry. Do you have any started some of that work already?
You did.
on on W, or we just talked about it in the last meeting? Is that something?
We discussed it.
Okay. Okay.
So immediately downstream of the influent pump station, we have two very almost identical headworks structures at both of the treatment plants. The headwork structures consist of a screen for removing the rags, a flow measurement using partial flume, and then we've got an influent sampler at plant two. The good news is that the screens hydraulically have a capacity of 6.2 million gallons a day each. So there isn't any expansion needed as far as replacing the screens at this time. Really, the only thing that needs to be addressed at the headworks is we've had some issues with the influent sampling, ragging up of where they take the sample, and whether there's been some concerns about are we always getting a representative sample on that. So there's been some suggestions that are discussed in the master plan about making some improvements to that, minor as far as cost. So there really isn't master plan. Our recommendations are as far as there aren't any major improvements needed at these headworks, but there are need to take care of the sampling issue, and that's about it with the headworks. any questions about the headworks?
No, sir.
Okay, so here's where we get the biological treatments, is what we call the secondary treatment facilities. That's your oxidation ditches, your secondary clarifiers, your return activated sludge pump station. It's all kind of what we call the secondary treatment facilities. And so we've done a pretty exhaustive analysis of your secondary treatment plants, the oxidation ditch clarifiers, and their treatment capability. Our analysis indicates that the basin sizes are good for about 2.0 million gallons a day average annual flow. That puts you at currently about 90% capacity. Our recommendations, one area that we do have a concern with the existing oxidation ditches is the ability to transfer oxygen into the treatment process. And so one of the recommendations is that we add an additional brush rotor or equivalent type device to each of the oxidation ditches to give you better oxygen transfer reliability.
Is that another bridge across?
It could be, or it could be like a floating brush aerator. There are a couple of options you can look at. Yeah. With the existing facilities, you can take a clarifier out of service during dry weather conditions, but you cannot take either of the ditches out of service, and that's a problem as far as operation maintenance of this facility. Our recommendation, the master plan, is that that one new ditch be added to plant two along with one new clarifier. And then we've already talked about adding the floating aerators to each of the existing ditches. With these recommendations, you would be able to take any clarifier to service at any time of the year and take any ditch out of service during dry weather conditions. So that gives you a lot of flexibility as far as operation maintenance of this.
What would the cost of that repair be?
$6 million.
$6 million.
Yeah. So here's the big hit on this, and this would be the most expensive component of these improvements. And that if you do all of these recommendations, new oxidation ditch, new secondary clarifier, new RAS pump station, you know, and the other improvements identified in this table, as up to total cost about $6 million.
Steve.
Yes.
Help me out here on table 21-1. Is somewhere in one of these items the additional brush rotor?
Part of the $6 million.
Is that part of item four?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay.
It's lumped in with item four.
Thank you.
Okay.
And then just to clarify, the improvements do two things. One is we're pointing out a deficiency and redundancy at the facilities, but also to accommodate the homes in the planning area and take the flow to 2.4 MGD, these are required. Okay, so there's two elements to them. One is a growth element, if you would. One is a redundancy maintenance element, if you would. So there's two elements as to why that is, but to accommodate the growth in the planning area, you need more flow. You can't get more flow through the two ditches that you have. You're gonna need a third ditch at some point to accommodate growth. And then, you certainly could use a ditch now relative to maintenance aspects of your existing facilities.
Yeah. You can't run the plant on one ox ditch.
That's correct.
At the current cell. So both ox ditches have to run. So if one of them broke, went down, we'd be in deep waste.
Yes, exactly. Deep waste.
That's correct.
Well put, right? So what you're saying then, Greg, let me see if I can state this a little. You have these things listed under critical improvements. Because of the reliability factor and the redundancy factor, the byproduct of that, it would also provide the ability to for build out that you talked about.
Right. Basically, you're going to need them anyway, and you have a redundancy issue now, and so by building them now, you would get, or you know, within 2 years, basically on the schedule, when you build them, you're going to solve your redundancy issue. Now, as a little history, when we built Plant 2. We built Plant 2. Plant 1 had been online for 10 years. We built Plant 2. We wanted to go look at what the status of the basin at Plant 1 was. So we immediately drained it, moved all the flow over to Plant 1, or Plant 2, drained this out, and what we found was the bridges had all corroded underneath, the rebar was all exposed, all the joints had separated in the basin. The basin was leaking. The bridges were, in fact, there was even discuss of an emergency basis bringing in temporary bridges because the people were concerned about personnel walking across them. And it took about 6 months working with contractors, cleaning them up, repairing them, recoating them, resealing them, and then Plant 2 went back in. Plant 1 went back in service. Okay, so since then, in 2002, no ditch has been out of service to look at either the underside of the bridges or in the joints in terms of how they were constructed and stuff. So. The thought being, you know, you're out of 10 years now. At some point, you know, maintenance is going to have to be done on those, and you really can't accomplish that right now. Is it an emergency you need to go build it right now? No. It's a question of planning and when do you want to put your redundancy in versus, hey, you also are going to need it at some point, so when do you want to do that?
And the chronological order of that was that Plant 1 was in service for about 10 years when you shut it down and then found this corrosion, and now we're at that same 10-year time span on Plant 2, is that correct?
And actually on both plants, because we repaired it and they're both
exactly.
Back in service. So that's basically correct. So both plants basically, since 2002, we're coming in 2012, so in 2012, they both had basically been online for 10 years, running continuously.
Any more questions about segment three?
Any questions from the public? Mm-hmm. Okay. Jump up. Well, or get up.
Of the $6 million worth of improvements, what of them are would nice to have, and what are really required? Because the design of Plant 2 should have included a lot of these things to provide for maintenance and downtime, and they weren't. So now you're saying we have to make up for design flaws of what happened when they did the construction of these facilities. And my question is, some of these things just it would be nice to have if we could afford it, or are these really required and they were overlooked when we did the first design?
All of these items are required if you're going to accommodate the uses in your district. So if you're going to accommodate a flow increase and additional homes, you must build these facilities. Okay. In terms of maintenance, okay, it's not uncommon to have a facility with maybe one oxidation ditch. You know, you'll see a really small plant that might have one ditch or something like that, or maybe one plant with two ditches. Okay. The issue then becomes. Can a ditch operate long term for many, many years? Yes. At some point, all ditches have to come out of service. Okay, so when that has to happen, you know, different people use different judgments. You know, some people can say you can go 20 years and you never take it off service. But at some date, some point in time, nothing lasts forever. So if you had no growth and you said, nope, there's no growth and we're not doing that, I would say at some point in time, you will have to take that ditch out of service. You know, if you make it.
Can I just pose a scenario? Because I asked the same, you know, I thought, well, we really need to do this. And if we didn't do it and we had an aqueduct go down, we would be fined about $10,000 a day. So it's about $300,000 a month.
Okay, then my question is, why didn't we incorporate this in the design originally to take care of this redundancy like they would in an airplane or whatever else?
I'm not going to go there.
Well, no, that's the question. Is why wasn't it in the design that we have now? Now we're saying we have to spend $6 million. But I think you just answered my question, too, is that is this really being triggered by future growth and not by existing?
Well, both elements. Like you said, if there was no future growth, at some point you're going to have to repair a ditch, and then you can't. So at some point, if you had no growth, count the years. They aren't good for 100 years. They're not good for 50. At some point, you have to take one out and work on it. And so the question then is, even without the growth, you're going to have to do something someday. Are you going to have to do something right today? Probably not. Are you going to have to do something here? All I can say is we went 10 years on the other, and we had significant structural issues that we had to go in and repair before it got really out of control. Now, could you let it go and let it get really out of control? Yes, but then you're into a situation where you still don't have the redundancy, and you still never have this plant. So both elements are in there, and I will say that I wouldn't say it was an engineering or a design deficiency that there wasn't three ditches. It's not uncommon for a plant to have one oxidation ditch, but then they just ride it out, and when they have the problem, they have the problem. You know, that's how it goes.
Okay, thank you.
Just one other thing I'll add. Typically, when you have a small plant that has one oxidation ditch, other provisions are made. They have the ability to say they have an emergency storage basin or something with a lot of storage and a lot of time so they can take care of it. So it's a critical emergency that's say 20 days or something, they can get in and divert to emergency storage base and do that work. And again, it comes down to economics. You can see it's very expensive to build these facilities, and small communities says, well, and maybe that was a decision at the time with the fact that you didn't have a third ditch.
Isn't that part of your overall proposal, though, to put emergency storage basin in?
Yes, it is.
Yeah.
Yes, it is.
Thank you.
How many days of storage did that hold, the emergency basin hold?
Yeah, it gave about 8 days.
About 8 days?
Yes.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Pretty hard to build an oxidation in 8 days.
Yeah. Well, okay. Just like I said, you don't know what the issues might be. Then you got to go in and fix them. And the last time it was down for 6 months.
Roger.
Better start behind the grass.
Okay, the next process that we'd like to talk about is the secondary effluent lift station. This is a lift station after the secondary treatment process, after the clarifiers. And what you have here is and it's interesting when you go back and look at the when this plant was originally built, you'll see that this was called a filter lift station. And it was designed that if you ever put future filters in, you would need this pump station. So the change when the filters were not included, they changed. I guess the name was changed to secondary effluent lift station. If no future filters, future peak flows can be accommodated by doing some things, overspeeding the existing pumps are on VFDs, and you can ramp those up past 100%, 110%, and you can get the flow capacity you need. If filters are added, the pump lift will increase because of that. So the pumps would have to be modified with new impellers and possibly new motors and maybe VFDs too. So under that scenario, you're looking at about $250,000 if at some point you do have to put tertiary filters in. So there would be some work required for this secondary pump lift station under that scenario.
Are the upgraded pumps required and the increased flow required to force it through the filters? Is that why?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, and that kind of depends on the selection of the filters, what the hydraulic head is. Yes, exactly.
I'm getting this stuff.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so the next next item would be tertiary filtration. As you know right now, you do not have filters
at the treatment plant. You may need to put filters in here if it turns out that this is the best alternative for improving your UV disinfection. If we continue to have problems with the UV disinfection system, that the current improvements done aren't good enough. If you chose to do reclamation, if you decided that you wanted to use this water for irrigating landscape unrestricted use, you'd have to put filters in. The state would make you put filters in for that. Mm-hmm. And who knows, down the road, future discharge requirements, if they get more stringent, that may require you to put filters in. One thing we did with the master plan is if this scenario leads us to putting filters in, we would probably recommend that you go with a flow equalization ahead of the filters to reduce the size of the filters that would be needed. When you go do the economic analysis, it would make a lot of sense at that point to have a white spot in the line so that you could control the peak flows through the filters.
And that falls under item 7, is that correct?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right, yes. I just want to make sure where it is on the chart, that's all.
It's one of the big numbers.
But it's out there too.
And you'll see it's item 7 on the cost table as possible or an optional improvement.
Understood.
4.6.
For the audience, we're looking at item there's a chart in your folder 20-3 which gives the pricing for everything.
21.
Sorry,
20-1. Yeah, we just handed it out.
20-1, sorry. Page 20-3. Table 20-1, and I just am trying to, and you can see that the items have been listed under by how important they are or what the priorities are. It's a prioritization chart, and so we're looking at where these things are being recommended to be done.
Okay, so this is probably the most complicated slide that I have on here, so I'm going to try to do my best to explain what's going on with the UV disinfection. There are basically three scenarios. Scenario one is currently what you have right now. You have to meet a coliform limit of 23. That's the most probable number per 100 milliliters, what that stands for, without filters. That's existing conditions. Scenario two would be to meet the same coliform limit with filters. And scenario three would be if you wanted to do reclamation, unrestricted reuse, you'd have to get down to 2.2 on the coliform, and that would require filters. That would be mandated by the state.
Mm-hmm.
For scenarios 1 and 3, at some point we require conversion of the existing. Your UV disinfection system has two systems or two channels. One channel has an older version of the lamps that are in there. We're calling those the Trojan UV 3000, and the newer system has the improved UV 3000 plus. So to upgrade the existing to what the new channel has in it, it's a little bit pricey, but it's about $1.2 million to do that. Scenario two requires only flow splitting improvements. In other words, if you chose to put in the tertiary filters, you would not have to make these improvements to the UV disinfection system. Now, I want to qualify that in that what really needs to be done first to really validate what the capacity of this UV system is to do a bioassay testing of it. The way the system's designed right now, if you don't do this testing, you have to use default numbers that have to do with the transmittance of the water, how well the light penetrates through the water, and their default numbers that are used to design this. The only way to really assess for sure what the true capacity of the UV system is to do the bioassay. So that was our recommendation in the master plan to do that first before you can make a really decision on where we are as far as the go down the road as far as UV disinfection for this plant.
I'm a little confused. If scenario one is the existing condition, what is the action that would cause us to have to convert?
If you needed, when we're talking again about build out capacity.
Okay. Yeah. All right. Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah. So. Right. Right.
Not current house.
Not current capacity. Yeah, I'm sorry. I should have prefaced that when I started that we're talking about scenarios for build out capacity.
Thank you. Yeah, because I'm looking at this going, wait a minute, put in a new one.
And actually, just to remind everybody, the whole master plan was, what's it going to take to accommodate everybody in the service boundary as identified on that original table?
Well, what do we need over the next 10 years?
Correct.
Right.
All right. And so assuming that over the next 10 years, these people came into the district, what are you looking at? All right, so some of the improvements, we also looked at redundancy, so it's a good question. Some improvements relate to redundancies, and hey, would you see a deficiency in your
$2,000 a house?
Some of the improvements relate to capacity also. And so that's a good question. Yeah, go ahead and ask those kinds of questions as we go through.
Any questions from the public at this point? Go ahead, Rick.
Yeah, I'm confused.
I'm looking at your chart, 20-1. And is that item number 9?
Number 10.
Okay, the million 2. Okay, thank you.
And that's a good point, Greg. Remember that this whole thing is set up based on the guidance that we gave you when we contracted with you for this study, which is a 10-year plan. And that 10-year plan expects there to be growth within the community based on the areas that are left to build out.
Right. And the reason the title on that column is certain or likely is without a bioassay, it's certain. But if you do a bioassay, it may not be needed. And that's what we're saying. Do the bioassay before you spend any money. And let's find out what you really need.
Okay. Okay, this slide has to do with the salinity reduction. We've pretty much covered this. The emphasis here is that, you know, look at source control because it's very cost prohibitive to do treatment at the plant.
A question?
One comment on this slide before we start. Your existing permit limit wants you to get to 1,000, which is the raw water out of your water plant is running 500. It wants you to get to 500 plus, you know, they understand you're going to add salt at 500, you're in there around 1,000. You have a hard limit, not to exceed limit, of 2,100 in your, you know, limit. You guys broke that for the first time last year. Okay, so you've been close before 2,050, you know, running in that range. You actually crossed over as an average. You averaged for the whole year greater than 2,100.
What was the repercussions of that?
Believe it or not, because you hadn't hit that fine, you actually weren't fined on it because you hadn't hit that number before. But you did exceed your permit limit, and I said there was a salinity reduction plan given to the regional board 2 years ago. Damn. We wanted to buy off on that plan before you spent money to go do testing and do things like that. They've never really commented or gotten back to us. There is a permit limit specifically that you guys have exceeded, and it's in your permit that you have to go do this plan to execute and identify what is the source of the salinity and what are your alternatives. It's basically identify the source of what your alternatives are for the purpose of the plan.
Brian, do you have a question?
Yeah, is there a way for us to go to the Regional Water Board? Do we need them to approve that plan before we can start the study?
The permit specifically said they had to approve it. So in theory, if you proceeded on it and they came back and you spent some money and did some stuff and they came back and said, well, we wanted something else, you'd have to spend more money to go do whatever else they wanted. The permit required them to review it. It required them to review it in 30 days and get it back to you. Obviously, that has not happened. And with the reductions of staff, the regional board and stuff, basically just not reviewing it. So it's a gray area in your permit because you should be doing something.
Can you make a note of that?
I don't think we want to compel them to get that report.
Yeah, that's always a questionable approach to take.
You're calling their attention to it.
You don't want it. You're
sleeping dogs.
You're poking the dragon.
Virgil, do you recall? I think we sent them a letter a year later.
Yeah. We sent them an update. Part of our permit.
We're actually, as part of our permit, required to send them an update. And in that update, we say, well, this is the data we gave you before, and we haven't done anything since because we're waiting on you to approve our plan. So we're actually required yearly to give them an update on our progress. And that update at the moment says, this is what we did before, and you haven't told us it's okay to keep going. So at some point, we probably should do some reasonable testing. There isn't a reason. You know, some things they're not going to say no to. Maybe the whole plan they wouldn't like, but, you know, there's probably, I would think, doing the testing that we've talked about, checking residences with and without water softeners and stuff is probably a prudent thing to start.
Okay.
You know, I don't see anyone saying don't do that,
okay.
You know, kind of thing.
Okay, so now let's talk about the emergency storage. You do have an existing 5 million gallon earthen basin at plant number one that's currently not being used. There are certainly some benefits to putting this emergency storage basin that you have back into at least usable service as an emergency storage basin. In order to do that, we'd have to reactivate pump station W. And then once we put the wastewater into the emergency storage basin, we've got to get a way to get it out. So we would need a return pump station for draining the basin. And this is the cost associated with doing that.
Just want to comment, Ray asked me how much time does our emergency storage basin give us. I actually did the numbers wrong. You flow 2 million gallons a day, this is a 5 million gallon basin. So you would have 2.5 days. So if you try to divert all flow to it, you have 2.5 days to solve whatever problem you have going into it.
Is that for a basin?
In the master plan, there's a section on wetlands treatment potential. Back in 2007, the district did a demonstration project to evaluate metals removal. Primarily copper was a concern at the time. The wetlands demonstration project did demonstrate removal about 90% of the soluble copper. But since that time, the permit conditions have changed were to changing the permit, the copper issue, compliance with the copper issue has kind of gone away. So there, at this point, there really isn't a need for the wetlands specifically for removing copper. However, it's out there. Our recommendation master plan is there may be possible future potential benefits if something changes in your permit regarding metals or pharmaceuticals or those type of things. It may be some benefit to having the wetlands out there. But the master plan doesn't recommend that we do anything, any improvements to the wetlands or do anything with it.
Basically keeping the service, and then also aside from this, you may not be aware that Berkeley has been doing research out the wetlands for the district. Berkeley's gotten in several grants to come out and do research. So the district now is kind of like for just maintaining the facility, sort of getting research done on their behalf. So that's basically the same, keep doing the same stuff.
Thank you. Sauls Hanlon, what we have at the plant is we have some existing sludge lagoons. Currently, one of two lagoons is completely full, and the other lagoon is reaching its capacity. I think back in 2007, they did some measurements, and there were lagoon at that time was about 25-30% full of sludge. So since that time, more sludge has been added to that. We do have, as far as the treatment process, we do have a bottleneck in that we have one small bell filter press. And it limits the capacity of removing sludge from these lagoons and processing it, dewatering it, and drying it. And at some point, this is going to catch up with us. And so the recommendation of the master plan is a two-phase approach. And my understanding is that you may already be proceeding with phase one, and is that we're doing that complete project?
Actually, one correction on this slide. Phase one is proposed to two bell presses and one solar dryer, and then phase two is the second solar dryer. Yeah, and even that, we've kind of broken down in phases where we said, let's just start with the belt presses, see what kind of improvements we can get with the existing systems, but solving the immediate bottleneck problem, and then plan for that one solar dryer as part of phase one. And so we're kind of building that in phases. Even phase one is kind of broken down into phases. So we're going to build the belt presses first, confirm how well our operation goes, and then make the decision that we need to build this, you know, that solar dryer number one as part of phase one.
Didn't you already approve the belt presses at 800 grand
piece? Yeah, we're under design and are ready to purchase that first belt press. So even we're recommending two belt presses, we're starting with one. And spreading in the budget over two cycles, so we're going to start with one belt press now, and I believe it's planned for next year to add the other.
Well, I think what my question is, we looked at them at 800 grand a piece. You've got them there 2.5 million. How did they go from 800 grand a piece to 2.5 million?
What do you see out?
Take 203 out, and that leaves you.
No. The cost of phase one is 4.65. The cost that includes a solar dryer and two belt presses. And then
right, but if I pull the solar dryer out, that still leaves you $2.5 million
right,
in the two belt presses.
And that solar cost
dryer.
Is...
I pulled the solar dryer out.
Right. That cost is on the high side because it's kind of a limited facility. Normally the cost, when you throw in the contractor's overhead and all the things that normally occur, you kind of need to run up. But what we're trying to do is build it in pieces at a little less lower cost. And that's essentially what we're trying to do. So when you guys approved $800,000, that clearly gets us into the expansion, the belt press facility gets us a new belt press, and it may eventually may even get us a second belt press at that cost. But the plan right now is let's start with one belt press, expand the facility, lay it out for two. Let's get that in, see how it goes, and then next budget cycle, if we need that second press, we can add it. And then if we say we need a dryer, you know, under the year out, we can.
That's not my question.
Okay.
My question is this: when staff comes to us and asks us to approve something and put it in a budget, mm-hmm. and tells us it's going to be 800 grand, I expect it to be 800 grand. So if it's going to be 800, it's going to be 2.5 for two of them. That's not 800 a piece. Where did the 800 come from?
No, that's the budget number we have. We put in, I think, 865 for this year and projected, I believe, 865 for next year in that number. And that was for the belt press component of it only.
Right.
That wasn't for solar dryers or anything.
I'm back in the solar dryer.
I know. I'm not sure where that number's coming from. We're working on the 1.6 million. That's the number that we're working on.
I guess what I'm trying to get to, and I'm not trying to be difficult, if that number's padded by so many hundreds of thousands of dollars, if everything else is on the high side, then we don't know what we're really looking to spend here in the future. We're looking at $40 million sitting here. Well, is it $40 million or is it $38 million or is it $36 million? I mean, if these are 800 apiece and now they're 2.5.
It's a lot.
Here's what I can tell you on these active solar dryers, because we've done several installations. I've got one under construction right now down in the city of Merced, seven of these dryers. The cost per dryer, that's a pretty solid number based on bids that we've gotten at other treatment plants. So you can figure that each one of these dryers is about $2 million, okay? So of that 4.65 million, the basic construction costs, we have construction costs and project costs, right? So for budget purposes, you have to look at what's your construction cost, what's your engineering cost, what's your everything combined. But just the construction cost for these active solar dryers is about $2 million.
I'm not talking about the dryer, I'm talking about the belt presses.
And then, so you have one dryer and two belt filter presses. Maybe we have to go back and look at that number.
Essentially, trying to break it up and build it in pieces low-key, we're thinking that we should be able to build it for $1.6 million. In terms of planning costs for the master plan, we assume that you might go out and include this work with another project. You'll have X amount of overhead assigned to this. You might have a separate construction management team brought in. And assuming that the district did nothing but just write a check. Now, in this instance, the district does do a lot of their own construction management, and so they don't hire a firm to do that. The district does do certain functions themselves to reduce their costs of operation and construction. When we built this plan, we're not in here assuming that the district is going to go do all these functions. We're assuming that if you went out and just said, hire someone to do everything, and all I did was write checks to the district, your cost is higher, and that's what this plan reflects, okay? Going in and using your staff to do certain things like construction management and us doing rather low-key engineering design and then limiting your buying one piece at a time and such, you're doing that to reduce your costs. And so, yes, staff has said we think instead of $2.65 million, we might be able to get it in for $1 million less, and we're going to start in pieces and see what happens. And that's essentially why we said let's start with $800,000. I think we can get one press in and the thing done, and we'll see where we're at. But in terms of this plan, in terms of the cost, this assumes if you went out as a public works job and said, hire me an engineer to design it, hire me an engineer to do construction management for it, hire a contractor prevailing wage, pay my legal costs in the district, all the costs incurred, this is what is a typical public works planning number, and the contingencies are actually in the plan where we show you have a contingency for construction, you have a contingency for legal and engineering administrative. And those contingencies that do have, they do pad the number, okay? And on a project where the costs are really well known, where the project is very tight and very clear, you know, all those contingencies don't necessarily make sense. And so when you pull out of a big plant where there's a lot going on, but you have contingency in there because you're just not sure of everything when you're doing a planning level study. But when you go to build one piece of equipment, there aren't as many unknowns, you know? And so to keep planning costs consistent, you know, we assume that, hey, everything has a contingency assigned to it, even if it's as simple as a belt press. You know, everything has a legal administrative fee assigned to it, even if you're not going to use any legal in this case. So the issue is you're building one little tiny piece of something, and you have an efficient staff to do it, and you don't need any legal costs to do it, and you don't have certain things that would come with, say, a big public works job if you just went and said, you know, go build everything in this, Mr. Engineer, Mr. Contractor, and don't call me until you're done kind of cost.
That's basically what we do.
The original draft in the master plan, before we went back and did the sampling, the belt press, I think, was separated out in the description in the cost allocation, if I recall. And that number was the 1.8 something. And that's the number that I believe we're still working on. That number's never changed in my mind.
Right.
Okay, the next section of the master plan deals with the plant SCADA system. The existing system, previous recommendation. There's been a lot of correspondence concerning the SCADA system. The contract operator has their own opinions of what needs to be improved out there, and we've done our analysis. But this is basically a summary, a very short summary of the recommended improvements. And I think everybody, including the contract operator, is basically in agreement that we need a redundant master RTU at plant number two, improved features for monitoring and control of the sewage lift station is lacking and needs improvement, and then begin long-term replacement of the obsolete PLCs on a priority basis. And so this is kind of long-term over time. If you were to add up the total cost in current dollars, it would be about $350,000.
I find it a little bit difficult to evaluate when we have this set as critical improvement, but yet when funds available. Doesn't help me prioritize it in my mind.
In the table, what we pointed out is we think that there are elements, the redundant RTU, and a couple other things that should be done fairly soon, but that other lift stations can be on a failure basis replaced with new, et cetera. And so we've broken it down in the cost table, critical improvements of about $100,000, and then other certain or likely improvements, $250,000, so that the idea is, hey, you need to spend an annual amount of just general improvements to maintain and keep your SCADA system working and functional. And there's some shortfall now that some redundancy and some other things would be nice to take care of instead of just waiting for something to fail.
Okay.
Okay, so this kind of brings us to the summary improvements in master plan. We already talked about the table, and so at this point, we've handed out the table. There's too much information to try to paste into the PowerPoint presentation, so we've got the handout. this table 20.1. And accompanying that, we've got a site plan for plant two that highlights for the master plan where these improvements are, the third oxidation ditch, the fifth clarifier, or the third secondary clarifier at this plant, at plant number two, and the other facilities. So at this point, if there are any questions about the cost table, summary cost table, we'll try to answer those questions for you.
Okay. Some of them I was asking as we went along because I was kind of been through this before, so leave that. But let's start with any of the other directors here that have questions and move forward from there.
I have a question on the critical improvements as far as time. Is that like 1 to 2 years out, or are those, I understand immediate, but like, should we be looking at that 2012-2013 time frame?
Yeah, that's a good point. You know, the balance on the critical improvements is two functions.
Yeah.
You know, they will accommodate growth. They'll also bring in redundancy. Okay. If you're not growing as a district right now, and you're willing to, you know, go with what you have now in terms of redundancy, you've done it for 10 years, okay, so it's not like, you know, the world's going to fall down, but you can let those slide around, okay? So the real question then is, when might you need to accommodate growth? When might you say, you know, I want to start sleeping at night, or I'm concerned that, you know, it's been 10 years, it's been 11 years, it's been 12 years, it's been 15 years, you know, what point do I say the redundancy starts to overtake whether these houses come along or not? We want to consider the redundancy issue. So at the moment, what we've kind of said is, look, if you wanted to begin operation 2014, you know, so the housing market starts to recover, things start happening. If you wanted to begin operation 2014, then you need to start planning. It takes about 2 years to go from zero to operating. You know, so you got to design it, you got to build it, you got to turn it on. So sometime in 2012, you need to start planning your engineering, you start doing your design, you know. And so really the key is, you know, if you say instead of 2014, you know, at that point in time, your oxidation ditches will have been in service 12 years, okay? If you say instead of 2014, I'm willing to go 15 years, then you could say, well, 2017, I want to be online, and we start in 2013. Or if the housing starts picking up, and you're like, well, I got a lot of people in the community who want to start developing their lots, we need to be online by, you know, this date. When is the housing market going to come back? You know, you need to start planning ahead of that. So the real thing is, when you want it online, you need to start 2 years before that. And at the moment, we just said, okay, let's say it's 2014 is when you want it online. That puts it under the reliability issue. You've had your ditches in operation 12 years. Not an unreasonable time frame to say it's time to start building a redundancy initiative of the plant. If you're saying I'm willing to push that a year or two, or however many years you guys are comfortable pushing that, you can delay it. But then the question comes, okay, when is the growth coming in, and when do I want to accommodate that? So the dates aren't in stone. The dates are a balance of those two issues.
Okay, thank you.
Can I ask a question?
Yes, sir.
Greg, we talked when we had our ad hoc meeting last week about current capacity needs versus future development requirements. Can we break those out at some point? Is there a way?
Sorry, what do you mean by current capacity?
Well, current capacity issues to meet current existing capacity, like the belt press situation.
Oh, right.
Okay? Versus we don't need it until.
Right, so that is, if you are deficient and you are short right now,
yes,
it is listed under immediate.
Okay.
So if you are short right now, we stuck it in immediate, as in you either have a redundancy issue that we consider serious enough that you need to go address it now, yeah, or you have a capacity issue that you are short now and you need to go do something about it. Okay. So if you need it now, it's under immediate. After that, critical is, hey, you can't get to where you wanted to go in the plan without building your critical facilities. Okay. Your dates are a little more flexible, okay, under critical, but we don't see you postponing them for 10 years. You know, we don't see you, you know, going that far. You know, it takes you 2 years to get it done, so where you land is kind of where you want to be as a district. Okay, also financing and how you go about financing is going to be important.
I guess, like, living on the edge.
You have questions, Mark? I can tell you, you have questions.
I've got several questions here. I'm looking at all the improvements. I'm looking at 40-something million dollars in improvements, which, of course, this district doesn't have $40 million.
You got to take that 15 off.
Okay, I'm confused on the 40 million. Where do you see
the RO?
I'm adding your 15.7, your 4.864, your 4.814, your 7.294, and your 5.332.
The 15's under on
the 15.7 million is for the reverse osmosis, and we're saying it is unlikely you will need to spend that money. But because you have a permit criteria over your head, I'm not going to say it's impossible that someone would say. What we're basically putting that number in there is so that you, the district, are alerted that you need, there's a lot better ways to go about it than trying to treat it at the plant that has been discussed and has been proposed, you know, as a permit function. So in our opinion, you'd never spend the 15.7. That's why it's listed as unlikely.
Okay. So let's go back to 25.5 million.
Okay. And then on the reasonable or possible, you know, the filters are not a certainty. This is something that we're alerting you that is a possibility. We don't know for sure that you'd have to spend that money. The same, everything in a reasonable, and that's essentially the filters under the reasonable, okay? Under the certain likely column, so there's 4 million there. Under the certain and likely column, we talked about the UV is $1.2 million of that, and that is what we're saying. A bioassay will help clarify that number, okay? And then the secondary effluent equalization goes with the filters. So the 2 million of that is, hey, how well is your disinfection going to work? And what we're doing is you just put in a new disinfection. We're proposing to do a bioassay, very certify its performance, and let's see how it works. And we'll know what our capacity is, and that will also be necessarily growth related. So at the moment, it looks growth related. We're not sure if you have to do it all, but if it is, it's because you're trying to accommodate new homes that come in. Okay.
So shouldn't we have done this as part of the of this study, so we know what we're talking about? And we're looking at maybe 4 million, maybe another 4 million, maybe this, maybe that. It doesn't really tell us what we're looking at.
Well, I can't predict the future. I can say that you have a requirement. This may be needed. You don't need to build it right now, but you should not think that everything Corbin told you, I have nothing to worry about. I mean, this is trying to give you adequate information for how you plan. That's why it goes intermediate. Those are things we think you need to build right now. The critical improvements, those first two columns, are you're not going to get to the planned horizon that we discussed. You're not going to be able to build out your improvements in the district without building the critical improvements.
That's my next question.
Okay. After that, it starts to become, hey, these are things that could happen. These are things that we need to be watching and monitoring. And if we can, as we get more data, you'll have more clarity on those answers.
Okay. Let me ask this last question. If you take out the future development,
okay,
and you go by what do we actually need now to sustain us without future development? Uh-huh. So I mean, as far as I'm concerned, the developers can pay for the new sewer. Right? We just
right.
have to pay for it. What do we actually critically need now for us?
Everything we have listed under immediate.
5 million.
Intermediate.
All right, and then if you don't care about redundancy, you're done. Okay, if at some point in time you want to say, hey, redundancy on the third oxidation ditch is a factor for me, I do want to have that redundancy built in, then at that point in time, you're going to pick up at least the $6 million out of the critical improvements column. Do you have some flexibility on that date? Yes.
Or until the bridge falls in the ditch.
Okay, but didn't you just say that was also planned for the future development? If
we're going
to reach our horizon, we have to do this?
I'm saying no matter what, you will have to do it to accommodate future development, yes. It also performs a redundancy fixture that you're suffering at the plant now.
Okay.
So both issues are intertwined with the oxidation ditch expansion. Yes.
So in essence, I guess what I'm trying to say here is, if it looks like builders want to come to town and start developing, we could wait long enough in here to find out who's going to pay for this, whether the residents have to pay for it or the developers get to pay for it.
So clearly, there are certain elements of these tables that are growth related, and there are certain elements that are related to what you need to build to keep your facilities functioning properly, and then the middle column of there's some redundancy issues, and there's some questions about how long you'll be able to go before you really need a third ditch anyway.
What I'm trying to get you to do is tell me which part of it is growth related. I'm sorry, I can't seem to get anybody to tell me this. What's growth related?
Okay.
I can answer. He's answered it twice.
Did he what?
Go ahead, Greg.
Okay. If you don't care about redundancy, everything in critical going right is growth related.
With the exception of the skate up.
Except for the skate up. Yeah.
Okay.
Except for the skate up. All right. Now, if you're going to come back and say, I also care about other things, at some point in time, I do need to do maintenance on those ditches. I can tell you a year that I would recommend, you don't have to follow that, you can go as long as you want and not do maintenance on your ditch, okay? But I'm telling you, you can't do maintenance on your ditches until you have a third ditch, okay? So if no houses came ever, at some point in time, over the next 20, 30, or 40 years or somewhere, you're going to have to take a ditch down and work on it. In which case, it wouldn't matter how many, whether you had houses or not, you need to build a third ditch.
No, I agree with you. We don't have a disagreement. I agree with you. What I'm getting at is, if there's a few years left involved here, and we know the developers are now looking to build in Discovery Bay, then before we step up and go borrow money because we don't have it, and then let the developers come in and build on it, and let the ratepayers pay for it, I would rather stick this out a little bit and let's see what the developers are going to pay for.
It's a balancing game of, I don't know what you call it, chicken or whatever, but it's a game of, you know, how long am I willing to wait for development to come along before I solve a problem I have in the plant versus, hey, the developers came along and it worked out both. Yeah, did it work out great for us? Yeah, it worked out for both of us, right? So, you know.
Go ahead, Ray. Go ahead.
My list.
Sorry.
Yeah.
Wait a minute. Actually, Brian had asked.
No, it's okay. Go ahead.
I just did some quick math, and it looks like it's about $2,000 a parcel.
I don't know.
$12 million.
Let's not jump forward. Put the cart in front of the horse. Yeah. Go ahead.
If you look, okay, I came up with a number of, if we consider the ox ditch as important criteria, we're at $8.5 million. Somewhere around there. If you don't consider the ox ditch, then you're about $2.5 million. And the things that I counted was, and number one, we have that influent pump station upgrade at $1,044,000. Well, actually, that's more of an expansion need, but we do need to do a $40,000 coat of the coating, so that's $40,000 instead of the $1,144,000. Then I have this number two, number three, so it's 378, 243,000. Then I've got the, we're going to do that plan, that test at 50,000, the $10,000 wears at 8 and 9. And then I'm only counting 1.6 on the number 13 for the two belt presses and the collection 15 and 16 and 100,000 each. That's how I come up with about $2.5 million. If you don't do, but I'm leaning towards that we should do the ox ditch.
Well, it's kind of what Greg had stated, and that is, how lucky do you feel? And how proactive are you going to be?
Well.
And and nonetheless, if there are costs incurred with improvements to the plant that accommodate new growth, then the developers are going to pay for that at some point in time. You can't say 100% of it is, there's going to be some items that you can't cut right down the line and say this is only for growth, and there's percentages to talk about and to negotiate. And it's just not quite that cut and dry. And again, it's a matter of how proactive do you want to be. It does bother me that we don't. There's no way for us to really know what status the current ox ditch is in, or the bridge is in. We have no. There's no way for us to go in there and look and see.
On either one.
Until we shut it down and take a look at it. And we do know. That what condition the other one was in 10 years, and there's nothing to say that the concrete's any better today than it was 20 years ago in the process. And that's kind of what, I think that's kind of what Ray's kind of saying too, is that it's kind of a scary thing. But anyway, did you have something, Brian?
Yeah, I did. Thanks. The ox ditch is really scary to me because, you know, what Ray said earlier, how much a day, Ray?
$10,000.
Yeah, that's pretty. That's a lot of money. And you said the last one was on for 6 months, right?
Yeah, you know, we were concerned about it when we moved flow over to plant two right after it was built. We drained it, and then we were surprised that basically all the joints had separated from ground movement.
0.8.
Okay, and we were also really quite surprised that the rebar was all exposed underneath the bridges, so all the concrete had come off under the bridges, and the rebar was exposed and starting to corrode, so we had to bring in people to clean that off and clean that up. And then there's just a lot of joints going all the way around that ditch. It took a long time to get contractors on board, find a product that would do that, and bring it back along. You know, like I said, I don't mean to be alarmist, okay, but at some point in time, you need to take out an oxidation ditch and service it. And at the moment now, you can't. Okay, it is true, as Stephen mentioned, there are facilities that only have one oxidation ditch, little tiny communities that have one oxidation ditch. But then to do maintenance, the water has to go somewhere. You know, and your emergency storage basin's got 2 days, you know, and that's it. You know, and so that's for like a true emergency. Like, you know, we've had a couple of those where, wow, we needed to, you know, we would have been nice to be able to divert flow. We couldn't. We had a couple of violations that resulted because of that. But in terms of at some point we have to do maintenance, and how long do you go between having a new maintenance and how long can you run? Oh. Yeah, it's not an exact science. No. All we can say is what we found when we after took that one down after 10 years.
I think the problem, especially with the ox dish, is for new development, yeah, we do need the new ox dish, but we also need it for something else. And what we're going to run into is that once you say new development in this community, that's what it's for, and that's the end of the conversation. But I'd like to see us at least, you know, look into the ox dish moving forward.
You can't see very much into it. It's really full of crap.
No, that's not what I mean.
Oh,
look
I'm sorry.
Into starting the process, because he said you guys start 2 years before you actually want to build. You know, so. But that was cute, though. Okay.
A little levity there.
You're
I agree. But I mean, I don't know what I agree to, actually, to be honest with you. I think that. That's what we're here to talk about, though. That's why this is a workshop. We're not taking any action. We're not taking any action. We're here to discuss this tonight, put out some points of views, think about it, and then at some point in the future, come back in and start talking about it from what are we going to do standpoint. There's no action to be here taken here tonight. I'd like to hear from the public. Does the public have any comments with regards to any of these things? Please come to the podium and speak if you do.
To go back to the salinity for a moment, the biggest non-exposure, $15.7 million, which we don't really expect now because the government hasn't caught up with it. Why can't you say to the board, the water softeners are the problem, so the board could go to the community and say, will you, in line with your civic responsibility, stop putting salt in your water softeners, assuming that nobody is putting salt in their toilets and flushing down their toilets, and listening to what Greg said, you have done tests in Discovery Bay proving that the water out is saltier than the water in. Why can't you use that to make that statement? It is the water softeners. What is the other parameters that don't allow you and many other people that I've talked to in my professional career, why can't you say that?
No problem. I can say clearly that water softeners contribute to the problem. I don't know how much of the problem they are, because they clearly put salt down there, but people also put salt in their food. And believe it or not, a lot of salt comes from just people. The salt in the food that you buy, and the salt is deceiving. People don't understand when you talk about concentrations and stuff. I would say my guess, the water softeners are probably half the problem, okay?
And that is the problem.
And if you eliminate water softeners, you would make a big step forward in solving the problem. Now, in the plan we gave to the regional board, we had said there's some pretty simple testing that we can do to really demonstrate what is that, how much that impact would be. Because I think everyone would say, if I'm going to spend money on this, I'd like to at least know the impact it's going to have. Not that it'll get better. Yes, it will get better. But people like to know, I can take 25% of the salt out, or I can take 50, or I mean, people would like to feel like if I spend $1,000, or even if the district as a board decided to do a buyback program and spend X millions of the public's funds or whatever, they'd like to know what the impact is really going to be of doing that. So on that particular issue, I think it may be prudent, even if the regional board hasn't approved our whole plan, do that testing, know what the impact will be, and then you can, then everyone, whether you go to the community and say, look, you solved the problem, or whether the board decides to do a buyback program or whatever, whoever spends money at least will know this is the benefit I'm getting for the dollar spent.
Well, I was proposing there be no money spent, there be no buyback, that we convince the citizens in Discovery Bay, we know what the problem is, or we know what most of the problem is, and ask them voluntarily to stop using salt in their water softeners. Even with your buyback program, there has to be an element of civic responsibility for them to agree to stop using their water softener and allow you to buy them back. I'm opposed to the buyback theory. I would rather make it a no cost to the district, no cost to the district, except maybe to do a little more testing to prove it if you need to do that, and I'll mention that in just a minute. But why can't we say to the community, we know what a majority of our problem is, and it's going to be a big problem in the future. Let's volunteer to stop using salt in our water softeners. And the last thing I wanted to say is, as a part of that testing, did you take a house or houses and have them voluntarily, okay, our water softener's operating, what's the salt out? And then we've stopped using the water softeners, there's no salt in it at all. What's the salt out? Yeah,
that's essentially the test we'd like to do.
Yes.
Is the water softener on for 60 homes, water softeners off for 60 homes. See, now the other thing that I'd like to point out, the reason the district built the water treatment plants is so that the water quality would be such that people wouldn't necessarily need water softeners. Now there is a perception in the community that everybody still needs their water softeners, but you could ask a very simple thing. It could cost no one any money to simply turn the valve on their water softener and bypass the water softener and use the water that the district is already treating. You could do that at no cost to anybody if they would all do it. Okay, so you certainly can ask for city response, and you can certainly do it at no cost.
I'll volunteer Pat's house.
Look, here's, but as a board, I have to tell you that I'm not willing to go to the public and ask them to bring their civic pride to forward when I don't have the facts. I mean, I'm not going to go to them and say, we know that if you stop using your water softener, we're going to deal with our salinity problem. If we don't know that that's in fact the truth, we don't know how much of it's going to be taken up until we do the studies. So until we do the studies, really nothing can be done with certainty and with any sort of responsibility to who we're asking to participate in the plan.
I think another thing is, too, is this could be something that could be taken up by the citizens if they wanted to. I mean, they could go around and ask, raise awareness about water softeners, but if we don't have statistics...
Virgil's been asking me for 10 years to quit using my water softener. Trust me, he's been doing that for 10 years. Virgil, did you have something you want to say?
I did, and that is on the salinity plan that's been talked about. We have staff has developed a rough proposal now. We have identified 62 homes. When I say 62 homes, it isn't going to the sewer manhole and grabbing a sample there. It is going to a sewage lift station that these 62 homes come into, grab that sample. Now, we've identified the area. Now, the next thing we need to do is do a survey within those homeowners to see how many have water softeners, what type of water softeners. Some of them may have the new technology type of water softeners that Steve talked about earlier that do not utilize salt. Once we've identified, but let's just assume all 62 homes use a water softener, our plan is to analyze that wastewater for about 2 weeks, develop a base plan. We'll analyze the raw water coming from your wells, analyze the treated water going to the home, then analyze the wastewater coming out of the home for 2 weeks, ask those 62 homeowners to put their water softener on bypass if they all have water softeners. Again, we'll just assume that they have. Analyze the same scenario again, see what the difference is from there. Then we have some facts, I believe, then we could go forward with whatever avenue we decide to go after that.
And I agree with that 100%. Yeah. And that would be a plan that we could implement at very low cost, because you're going to be running that, you'd be running that study.
And we have started big part of that, and our next step right now into that phase is doing the survey on the individual homeowners. What do you have?
Where are these homes located?
They're in Discovery Bay West. Because it's so isolated to one lift station,
say,
it makes it so much easier to do that.
It was interesting, the newer water softeners or just the more expensive water softeners have the cartridge system? In other words, if they're the newer water softeners, how come Discovery Bay West doesn't have lower salt because they're newer homes?
It depends on the sales guy going over there and convincing right. the homeowner. Look at the quality of your water.
Also, I think most of them were built by the builder installed the water softener as part of the original construction.
No. Oh. Is that true, Virgil?
No. Okay.
He
plumbed it out. Okay. So the homeowner put their own water softener in at that point. So then cost. Certainly, the membrane types are more expensive. They're more expensive to purchase and they're more expensive to operate.
Okay.
So as a homeowner, what did they pick? Most of them picked a traditional water softener.
Which are the pellet or rock salt?
Yeah, rock salt.
Okay. I think, hey, I'm with you, Mr. Richardson, on the fact that as soon as we can get a study where we can actually go to the public and say, listen, you guys, we can play the Russian roulette with the water control board, and they can come back and say, you got to spend $15 million on reverse osmosis, or we can voluntarily, you know, address this system in a way that's going to benefit the community. Can anything be done from a water treatment? Virgil, this might be a question. Well, it might be. I don't know who this question is for, but I'm going to throw it out there. Somebody answer it if you can. Is there something that can be done with the water treatment? Because perception of it not being hard water is not just perception.
Yeah,
my wife loves to go on vacation and wash her hair someplace other than in Discovery Bay, because it just, I mean, even her parents' house in Milpitas, it's Hetch Hetchy water. It's unbelievable. And so, I'm sorry, I got distracted there. Is there anything they can be doing in the treatment of our water that will actually help with that situation? And we can say to the public, hey, you know, if you'll do this, we'll do this, and we're going to actually help with the hardness of the water even better than we do. Is there anything more that we can do from a water treatment standpoint to help that situation? So there's a real impact on the quality of the water.
I just had a thought that a lot of the questions you're asking about this, a very good case study is the city of Dixon. And I'd be more than happy to share the engineering studies that have done there, what results they have. I'd even be willing to bring in the engineer, project engineer that worked for the city, have them come to one of your meetings and present what they did and talk about that if you'd like.
Good.
And I will say, you can treat the hardness at your facilities. Some of your site space is pretty limited, so I don't know if you could physically put the hardware in, but yes, you can treat water
without going to
the homeowners. You could treat it, for instance, at the source where you guys make the water. You have filters now. The intent of those filters was to improve the water quality. And yes, you could do more. I don't know if you have enough site plan. I don't know if the master plan or the water master plan address it. No. Okay.
It's very costly.
It's very costly?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Yes, Ms. Richardson.
I don't know where this question fits in, but I'm looking at all of you drinking your bottled water because you don't like the taste of the water, and neither do I. How do we make that better?
I've been trying to do that for 35 years here.
What do you do?
Nothing.
I'll take a professional answer over here.
not inexpensively can you solve that problem.
Is that the answer?
Yeah, you can solve it if you want to spend enough money, but I don't think you have the physical space to do it. I don't think you have money to do it. Did they do taste and quality as part of the master plan?
Did you have something?
Yep. Do we see any changes in CEQA, or do we see any change in California's that may impact this master plan as far as the requirements?
Permitting?
as far as permitting, it's interesting because really the one thing that 10 years from now that may be entirely different is this salinity issue affects literally every community in the valley, as you probably know. And the it is a high priority for the state regional board to, they've got a special, what they call CV Salts committee that's been formed, and they're spending a lot of money to try to come up with the ultimate solution to this salt problem that we have in the valley. But it's been talking about it for decades. Who knows where that's going to end up? But if all the things I see in your permit, the one thing that, like I say, right now, you know, the goal is to get down to 1,000. You're at 21. Your permit's at 21. They recognize that it's a very difficult issue to treat. You know, it's very expensive to treat that. That's why there's some leniency in your discharge permit now. If I, you know, 10 years from now, are they gonna, what are they gonna do? Who knows?
But what triggered Dixon?
Well, Dixon had a similar issue, but the difference with Dixon is it's a land disposal treatment plant. It was ponds, and there was a belief that the that they were contaminating the groundwater, making it worse, and it was the, you know, there was a lot of finger pointing. Was it the farmers or was it the treatment plant? And there were a lot of studies done, and this all came full circle on Jesus. Are we going to spend millions of dollars on at the treatment plant to resolve this? And there's, or are we going to try to do source control? And it, in every case, whenever it's been looked at, source control is the least costly option for any community, really. And and I'd be happy to share with you where they are. I mean, it's not fully resolved yet what they're going to do, but at least they've taken some steps and they're seeing some results from that, and we can share that with you.
I think it's a good idea to at some point. I mean, this is obviously an issue that's not going away. Yeah. That we would have the engineer come down from Dixon so we could maybe ask them some of these questions. And it's never too early to start a campaign like that. In fact, we need to get serious about this. And I jokingly say Virgil's been trying to get me to this for years, but it's true. And I think that if we need to start an education campaign with the community, saying, "Hey, look at here's the cost impact it's going to be to your household," and then take a look at whether that's effective or not. If that's not effective, I mean, obviously the place to start is at as low cost as possible. And that would be through education and volunteer, and then and give that an opportunity to work, and then see what happens to go forward from there. But the first thing to do, and Virgil, thank you for starting that process, is to get that testing going, so we know what kind of impact that's really going to have on the water that's coming out of our at the very end.
I think as a minimum, if you get under the 2100 again, it should be a priority, because
that has to happen.
You didn't get fined, but it doesn't mean there is an environmental group that's sitting and waiting to come back and say you're impacting because you're exceeding your permit. You're impacting the water quality in the Delta. You remember, you guys have been hit several times before with lawsuits out of the blue. Some of them you may go away or whatever, but essentially it came back with, "Hey, you're violating your permit. That's an automatic impact to the Delta of this magnitude." And you know, certainly I would say I think a legitimate effort needs to be made to get you back under 2100. That isn't very far. You're at 2200. You know, you're talking about dropping 100 points. Okay, at least then you can say we're not violating your permit right now, but right now you are. And so a legitimate effort to do that, I think, should take place.
Can we not talk about violating the permit?
And we also, 1 year is one thing, 2 years a trend. Yeah. So we want to try to not have that happen also. Any other comments from the public or questions, or how about from the board? Anything else that we want to go? Mr. Armstrong.
Good evening, Mark Armstrong. Very interesting presentation, and I
read through your master plan a couple of times, so very thorough. The salinity issue with a new development like ours can be addressed in a different way, which is essentially to require certain kinds of water softeners to be installed and used as opposed to others that create a problem. So I think you have some tools at hand to deal with new development like ours. The back and forth question that was discussed, looking at the oxidation ditch, it's obviously something that is, even if there was no new development, it's, as your engineers have commented, it's something that you need for redundancy purposes. Mm-hmm. We would pay our fair share of that cost. We'll pay for the costs associated with providing other improvements that are solely for the purpose of our development. That's our responsibility. And our responsibility would be with respect to other improvements that are necessary. Even if there was not that new development, we would be responsible for our fair share of that as part of the new community.
Thank you. So when you, Mark, just one other question. So yeah. When you're saying, back to the salinity issue for a moment, so you would address, you could or might address that by actually installing at construction softeners that were already in compliance, or that didn't have the salinity issue, and that way it wouldn't be a problem in the future? Or
I would anticipate that would be something your staff would suggest that we have as part of our service agreement.
Right, okay, that's what I thought.
Just
a hunch?
Just a hunch.
Thank you.
Yeah,
that makes sense.
Sure.
You know, that's a good point, and that's something that, you know, once those projects start to move through the development process, through the county, the conditions of approval can indicate what those requirements might be.
And if that's in place, there's no reason to replace it with a different
height. That's an issue you all can address, irrespective of whether the county addresses it, because it's your bailiwick.
Right.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
That would actually help our overall numbers come down, because we'd have a solution.
Sure.
From an additional home that don't have salt.
Right. Mm-hmm. Rich?
Well, I'd like to say that I agree with Mark, that I think that some of these immediate improvements could wait until the developer comes in and you can have the developer pay for it. But if you feel you need to have some of these things done now, you could borrow the money and then have to put on conditions of approval that the developers reimburse you for improvements that were put in anticipation of the growth and upgrading and redundancy of the existing system, just to make development available, plus make them pay for the new improvements for wells, water tanks, sewage treatment, whatever you have, and that would get you reimbursed. And but in the meantime, you'd have to borrow the money and pay some payments and interest charge, but you borrowed money before for other projects. And maybe that's a solution that would work and satisfy some of the board members, because I don't think the existing public or the existing customers in this district should have to pay for the redundancy or the other improvements. And the other thing I would like to address is that when Discovery Bay West came in and they were got approval and got will serve letters for water and sewer, there was a studies done that analyzed what water improvements and what wastewater improvements were required to accommodate 2,500 homes or whatever it was. And I think it was more than just Discovery Bay West that was included in the study. And now there's at least 600 homes I know of that have been approved by the county and been approved by the district because they've built the improvements, the street improvements and the water and sewer. And now the plant doesn't have capacity to serve these, and the developers already paid based on these studies and agreements the district had entered into years ago when Discovery Bay West was approved, is now going to have to pay additional fees to build these 600 homes that have already been permitted and approved by the county and by the district. And my question is, why doesn't the existing plant, which was designed to handle all this, and have capacity to handle these without doing any improvements? And also, we were told many times by this board, not particularly individually of you, but the board at the time, that this was a state-of-the-art sewage treatment plant, and that we were going to sell fertilizer and not have to take and haul things away. And we've asked many times over the years, well, how are we doing on the fertilizer? Have we sold any? And we were told by the management that we're working on it. Well, I don't think you've sold any fertilizer, and I don't think you've got state approval to sell fertilizer. And that's a failure of the original design that was really publicized all over Discovery Bay, that it was going to be part of the project and was going to save the district a lot of money.
If I could answer that, please state.
The fertilizer part?
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
First I've heard of it, so.
Well, the biosolids was constructed after the original plant was built. So the biosolids project, which does make Class A biosolids, you do have the legal right to sell it. You are fully capable of doing so. In this instance, it was just land applied. The entire biosolids produced for last year was just land applied on the farm field behind the treatment plant. It's available to the public at any time. Has the district gone out and put a big marketing campaign to, you know, push the public to purchase the product? I think that staff has discussed it with people. There have been people that have tried it. No, they haven't sold any of it. Okay, but it has been used, and it all has been used. In fact, all the sludge that's been dried has been agriculturally applied to the fields.
But that's district property.
That is district property. That's correct. But they are free to grow the hay on there.
Can we keep putting it on district property if we don't have any buyers?
You can keep putting it on there every year. So at the moment, it's available to the public. They're free to come get some at any time. Are they bagging it and selling it at Home Depot? No. Okay. All right. But anyone that wants to reuse the product in their landscaping, and the farmers that want to use it, is available to everybody. Are they making a big push to market and sell it? No, they're not. But they are, I think, trying to get the word out. And the material is being reused. It's not just being thrown around or something like that.
Okay. Thank you.
Good questions, Rick. I am as puzzled as you are as to why capacities didn't match up to what they were supposed to be. But I without a crystal ball, that's a tough question to answer. But I was puzzled as you are on that. Go ahead, Brian.
I don't know if we're in a position where we can't expect the current ratepayers to pay for redundancy. I don't really think it's also fair to make new development pay for the redundancy of what came before them. I mean, we're in a situation that should have been handled a long time ago. And if I remember right, the belt thing we've known about for a long time, 8 years?
That is correct. The original facility was built without any belt press or biosolids facility. It was put in the lagoon. When the district paid to empty the lagoon the first time, they basically let the sludge build up for a long time. The lagoon was full. Mm-hmm. We got to pump it out now. They went out and contracted it out, and I think it was a $500,000 or $1 million. It was really expensive, and they didn't really move that much sludge. Based upon that, we went back and said, well, you know, this is a better way to do it. Let's put a belt press in, and let's put a solar dryer facility in and make a nice product for the community. The product is being reused. The community isn't ready to buy the product. That's true. But you also now have put in those measures to allow you to process biosolids and at least keep up. Now, at the time, we knew it wasn't all of what you needed for all of your facilities. It was, let's start small and see where it goes and see the product we make and see the progress we make. And that's why we phased in the biosolids facility, and that's why we're even saying now, don't necessarily rush out. I mean, yes, we show $4.6 million. This is technically on paper what you need to process all the biosolids that you make okay? But even now we're saying, let's go in there carefully. Let's not just shoot and go and build it all. So that's why we started with, let's add one belt press, see how our capacity goes, plan for the next belt press. All right, then we'll establish, do we really want to build that third dryer or not, you know, in year two or three down the road.
I don't pretend to be a historian of the district, but a lot of the things that I've seen since I've sat behind this table is a lot of things seem to be pushed down to the very last moment, you know, that it has to happen. And we keep pushing things back and pushing things back, and sooner or later the chickens come to roost, and the ox dish just really scares me. I think that could be really expensive and something that we have to address.
Yeah, and I would say that, remember, the plan is for everybody to grow in the district. In terms of the ox dish is absolutely required for new growth. No one can come in without, to accommodate everybody in the district, you must build an oxidation ditch, okay? There's also a redundancy element. So normally in this situation, you would sit down and you would say, okay, how much of this cost is really on the redundancy back?
Mm-hmm.
How much of this cost is really supporting new growth? Because it's clear you cannot build anything without building an oxidation ditch. So clearly it supports growth also. So you have two purposes. It's very common. When you have existing facilities, new growth coming in, things get interrelated. You start using things for multiple purposes, and essentially you go through and you assign a cost ratio of, okay, how much of this is really new growth? How much of this is a benefit to the existing users? Okay, and you work out and you say, okay, we're going to charge this to new growth. We're going to charge this to existing customers. Mm-hmm. That has not been done. We are simply identifying what needs to be done to accommodate everybody in the district. You know, that was the purpose of this plan.
Thank you.
Director Tetro.
Yeah, one of Rich's comments, you were saying that we have to add additional capacity to accommodate the 700 homes. That's not true. When we're talking about currently what the capacity the plant will handle, including all of the 600 homes.
No,
the treatment plant will.
It's included in the growth numbers.
No, it's not.
No, that
you're wrong.
To clarify that. To accommodate everybody, we got to build it. Okay. Right now, on paper, related to the 600 homes specifically, there is a slight shortfall. Okay. So on paper, we're looking at it and saying you can accommodate about 424 homes.
Okay. Yeah.
Okay. There is a slight shortfall relative to the 600 number being bandied around right now. And yes, that issue needs to be addressed, and we need to work on that issue because it has implications both for the district as well as developers and the plant that was constructed. I'm not saying there isn't an issue there. I'm saying that's kind of where it sits.
Did you want to comment back on that, Rick?
I'd like to ask Craig a question. You know, the district approved an out of service. Out of your boundary expansion of the sewer and water on Bixler Road to build a school that accommodates 500 or 600 kids. Now, did we then give away some of the capacity of the plant that should have gone towards the 600 homes?
School's closed down. It's not.
I know,
okay.
But they still have to make allowances for it.
It's a valid question. Someone please address it.
There's people
it was
not
before my time.
There's people not living in homes out here also. But they were counted.
Right. Once you make a connection to the district, you have to assume it'll always come back and be used. So you can't give it back. So we connected it. Now, correct. There are things in Discovery Bay that got built and connected to the treatment plant that were not originally planned to be built and connected to the treatment plant. Yes. Okay. So there was also a reimbursement agreement with the Hoffman Company, and there were some payments paid back and forth. And so, yes, there was some bargaining going along with the homes, with the school. You know, so certain things that did get hooked up and are connected and part of the district now were not in the original planning 10 years ago. So, yes, there is some of those went there. Now, that was anticipated for a certain number of homes, and so we have to go back and carefully, and we've created a table to start discussing with the district of where maybe some of these things came on, what's left, you know, that type of thing. And so, yes, there are some things, the school, Ravenswood Development, weren't originally in the district.
Okay.
Well, I think Raritan is what is included in the study when they did Discover Bay West. I think it's in agreement that there was like 500 homes or something to that effect.
We bought back 500.
But it was included.
Which we paid for.
And I think the capacity in the new plant was supposed to include Ravenswood plus Discovery Bay West.
Rich, I can address some of your concerns. And I wanted to comment on something you said earlier. The Hoffman Corporation has had several conversations with staff, and part of what you're saying is occurring in that there will be negotiations and conversations and justifications and quantifying of exactly where we stand. That is an issue, and it is being addressed. And as we move forward with the building of those homes, it will have to be addressed. We're probably not going to all agree right off the bat where the responsibilities lie. But that's a negotiation that will be a part of the process of moving forward with the building of those homes.
Okay. Then I think you ought to consider the out-of-district or out-of-scope or the things that the district's taken on the overall capacity.
That will definitely be part of the discussions, I'm positive. Appreciate that. I do want to go back to one other thing you said earlier and comment on that. And again, something that's already been in discussion, Rick and I had an opportunity to go to a convention, CSD convention down in Monterey for a couple of days, and see what other challenges that other districts similar to ourselves has had, and then also meet with resources, different options and such. And we've looked into that finance option that you're talking about, of spreading it out over multiple years to where the debt service is minimal for the current. And minimal is a relative word, but minimal for the current ratepayers, and then it's spread out over a long period of time, and it fits into some reasonable budgetary situations. And we're actually getting numbers from different resources at this point to see if that's a viable option. So we have started looking into that also. Sometimes I forget the things that we do that sometimes doesn't. Just because it happened in someplace else, but that is one of the options that we're looking at, and I think it's a viable something viable to look at is because the debt service is relatively minimal to the current ratepayers as opposed to a huge expenditure.
Moving forward, what I'd like to do is, well, first of all, with respect to that last comment, this last suggestion, discussion item, I should say. Hitting the street tomorrow is going to be the RFP on the connection fee, capacity fee. I'm sorry, the capacity fee study.
Right.
So that's going to be hitting the street tomorrow, and I've got a number of firms that are interested in that. And so that is going to be part of this whole process. And they will take a look at the master plans, they'll look at our connection fees, they'll look at current capacity versus future demand. And assess that information relative to what our capacity needs are going to be, so what future development would pay to have to hook into the system, number one. The second thing I want to have take place is we've now had a presentation on the water master plan. It was earlier in the summer, and now tonight on the wastewater side. What I'd like to do shortly after the first of the year is schedule a marriage of the two, if you will, and have them both come in as just as a summary kind of review what we've talked about, and then start to develop the recommendations of the board moving forward, because we're going to be starting on preparing the budget here pretty soon for next year. We're going to be starting on that right after the first of the year. So what I want to make sure we do is we make sure that we have the direction of the board moving forward, and there are issues, as we all know, on the water side of the house as well. And you can't look at them in a vacuum. We have to look at them as a whole. So what I want to be able to do is schedule that, like I said, sometime after the first of the year, have a workshop, have basically these two and Ludorf and Scalmanini come on in and kind of knock it out in one evening or an afternoon or something like that. So if that's, if that is reasonable to the board, that's the direction I'd like to move in.
Sure. Sounds good. Any other comments or
questions about this workshop here this evening. Any more questions for our engineer staff or group here? All right. If there is nothing else, are there any future agenda items that we've brought out of this?
Just the future workshop.
And also the request.
I thought there was going to be a discussion of bioassays for the UV.
Bioassays actually on the next agenda.
Oh, okay.
So yeah.
And then as a future agenda item, sometime in the future, maybe considering bringing in the engineer or the somebody from Dixon.
Yeah.
Anything else? Then
I guess I would ask. If there isn't at some point a schedule put forth, if the district wants to proceed with the testing of the salinity inside,
well,
I'm
under the impression that's going to be moving forward, and Virgil will probably be bringing some recommendations to the board for action on that.
We've already started the process.
Is that what you're talking about?
I know there'll be a cost of actually like testing samples and things like that.
Even though we can't take action, we can give direction.
Yeah, we'll come back.
And I would just say that Virgil, it's the desire of the board that we move forward with that aggressively. That's because that's an issue that we really want to address. And I appreciate the fact that staff's doing that as a cost factor too. So, anything else?
Yeah.
Greg, did you have anything else? Hearing none, and based on the new resolution, the meeting's adjourned.
Thank you.